KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Today with a chance of showers. It's going to be partly cloudy tonight. Chance of showers, the low in the upper 30s. Partly sunny again tomorrow, the high in the upper 40s.
I have just called President Obama to congratulate him on his victory. His supporters and his campaign also deserve congratulations. I wish all of them well, but particularly the president, the first lady, and their daughters.
Tonight, in this election, you, the American people, reminded us that while our road has been hard, while our journey has been long, we have picked ourselves up. We have fought our way back, and we know in our hearts that for the United States of America, the best is yet to come.
That was President Barack Obama and Mitt Romney last night, concession and acceptance speeches at the Westin Ballroom. There was quite a bit of cheering when the TV networks called it for President Obama. Just to give you a flavor of that. And also at the Westin, there were women who were celebrating President Obama's victory as well. They had some things to say about why they thought the president and some of the other candidates who won around the country did win. They were looking at some of the ideas and the demographics.
Oh, elation. Great. Great night for Democrats. Great night for Washington State.
I'm blown away. I'm over the moon. I'm excited. I'm waiting for the concession speech from Romney.
I'm just going to say yes. I'm happy and I'm pleased that it appears that the general populace realize it takes longer than 4 years to turn a country around.
Governor Gregoire is a woman. She's also the governor of Washington State. Governor is a woman, and as the governor, I want to thank you for joining us. You're the woman. I'm the man. I want to thank you for joining us. And I want what was your reaction to what happened around the country last night in terms of women? More women than ever representing states in the Senate. What happened,
Steve? I thought it was an amazingly exciting night for the country. The president being reelected handily, historic, particularly when you think about the unemployment rate. But his message, which is very clear on that of Bill Clinton, you can't get it done in just 4 years, obviously resonated, and the country overwhelmingly reelected the president. And I can't tell you how excited I am to see the number of women that have been elected to the Senate, because there's a sharp contrast, frankly, Steve, to what's happened among the governor's ranks. We now will have only one Democratic governor, female, in the country, Maggie Hassan. And I went back to help her during the course of her campaign because I was so concerned at the fact that we've had a good number of Democratic women governors, but we were without, and we finally were able to get Maggie Hassan elected, and so thank goodness we'll have one. So that I'm pleased about, but overall I thought it was a great night for the country.
You're also going to—you won't be in that next meeting, but the next time all the governors get together, these governor-elects, there's more Republicans as governors than any time since the 1920s. So the Republicans are having some inroads into the state chairs.
Right, but I, 2 years ago, I was actually the head of the National Governors Association when we brought in the biggest change ever of new governors, and a large majority of them were Republican. But, governors have a way, frankly, of not letting partisan politics get in the way to get things done, because at the end of the day, we have to govern. The organization, I think, will continue to be strong and, in fact, may become stronger in its influence in national politics. If Congress cannot get past its divisiveness, I think the country is going to have to look to leadership among the ranks of the governors who will set partisan politics aside. Chris Christie, by way of example, when the storm hit, because they know at the end of the day they've got to serve their people and govern.
Governor, the Obama administration has some seats to fill around the cabinet and other places this next term. If asked, will you serve in the next Obama administration?
You know, I don't know. I've been so busy, I haven't had much time to think about that. I've always said to myself, if your president calls you and asks you to serve, I'm not sure how you say no to that. But I haven't actively pursued anything. I'm right now on pins and needles waiting for my husband and I are waiting for our first granddaughter to be born. I've got work to do here, and I'm not going to quit till noon on January 16th. So I'll see, but I'm not ready to cross that bridge yet and say what I would do.
Governor, congratulations.
Thank you. Very exciting for us.
Grandparenting.
Yes.
Always a new world, I bet. All right, let me ask you a couple of tough political issues still facing us, but let me start with something maybe not so tough. You came out in support of Referendum 74 of same-sex marriage in this state. What do you make of the outcome, and what do you make of how closely divided our state is on that issue?
Well, again, let me go to the national level. Marriage equality passed in Maine. Marriage equality passed in Maryland. In Minnesota, they turned back a constitutional amendment that would have said no to equality. And in Washington State, I'm feeling very good. I think we're going to be able to stand up and be proud that we're going to once again say we believe in equality in our state. So when I look at it from that perspective and from the fact that no one has been able to accomplish that around the country, I couldn't be more pleased, more excited for the people of the state of Washington. This is an issue that may be close today, but I believe over time you're going to find that it's not going to be. So we're just at the front of history making. Others will follow us. We're in a leadership role.
December 6th, it looks like it will be illegal for somebody to possess marijuana. You'll still be governor. Any thoughts on how you want to see that law implemented?
Well, obviously the big question will be, what is the United States Justice Department going to do? It is illegal under federal law. You now have potentially two states, Colorado and Washington, that would allow for recreational use. I just don't really, Steve, have a good feeling for what the Justice Department is going to do. They're obviously cracking down on misuse and abuse of medicinal marijuana, particularly in states like Colorado and California. So the jury's out on what happens. But meanwhile, my job as governor is to do what the people of the state of Washington have said they want done. So up until January 16th, I'll do everything I can to begin the process of implementing it through the Liquor Control Board, where they will have primary responsibility.
Do you have any say in who's going to be on the commission that will oversee some of the implementation of those laws? I forget how that initiative was written.
It starts in the governor's office, so we'll be initially responsible for it. It's one of those issues, however, as I'm leaving office, that I would hope that I can work directly with the governor-elect and make sure that, however, I'm going to proceed is in keeping with the wishes of the governor-elect so that there's no hiccup in the process of implementing it.
And Governor, in terms of the legislature, and you still saying you still have some work to do, reaffirmation of the two-thirds rule by the Tim Emmon initiative by the voters, what are you looking at in the next few months before you're done that you want to see the legislature accomplish that you think you can accomplish?
Well, the jury's still out, meaning the Washington State Supreme Court, on whether the two-thirds is constitutional. They've got the case before them. It's been argued and briefed. We're waiting for a decision, and it might happen, frankly, over the course of the next couple months before the legislature meets. My job really is to tackle the next budget. We already know we have a shortfall of about $1.1 billion, and that's before we even look to the K-12 funding issue, which is about another billion-dollar challenge for us. We've got transportation needs in the state that we cannot look away from. Both candidates, particularly Jay, talked about jobs. For jobs, you got to have the infrastructure. And I tried to introduce something last session. It didn't work. It takes a while. I think we're going to have to look at that. So for me, my work is going to be revolving around how do I get a budget ready, how do we step up to the challenge to fund education, and how do we get transportation on its way so that we can ensure that we're ready once we get out of this recession to meet the national predictions that we're going to be one of the most vibrant economies in the country.
All right, so Governor, you can try teeing that up, of course, but we don't know who the governor is going to be at this point. More votes to count, especially in King County. Parting words, recommendations for whoever comes into the seat that you're now sitting in.
You know, I love my state. Over 8 years and probably four of the toughest years that anybody has served, I have the utmost respect for the people of the state of Washington, and I think the best is yet to come for us as a state. So whoever replaces me, and at this point it looks like Jay is solidly in the lead, my only ask is, you know, keep embracing the thoughts, the will of the people of the state of Washington. They're leading on marriage equality. They passed marijuana. This is a state that embraces its diversity. It's an economic powerhouse internationally. Its people are grounded in the best values. And so congratulations to whomever replaces me. You've inherited one of the best states in the country.
But, you know, Governor, you have said both of them were not being accurate when they thought they could fund education fully without dealing with the revenue side. You still stand by that?
Oh, absolutely. When you look at the challenge that I have before me, which is a $1.1 billion deficit, before we get to the bill on K-12 education funding of another billion, I think you can see after 3 years of cutting $12 billion, we are in the midst of a number of lawsuits because we have cut so much. We are down to 1996 staffing levels in state government, and the demand is growing. So we're struggling to see our way through the recession. We're doing an excellent job, but to think that we can cut more or somehow the economy is going to, you know, return quickly, it's just not going to happen. So I want to work with whomever succeeds me so that we can get ourselves going. But revenue is one of the things that cannot be off the table at this point, in my opinion.
All right, Governor. I look forward to talking to you again for a longer interview. And congratulations again on becoming a grandparent. That'll
Absolutely.
Be great when it happens.
Thanks, Steve.
Thank you.
Have a good one.
And you. That's Governor Chris Gregoire. David Domke is professor and chair in the Department of Communication, UW, back in our studios. You're pulling double duty, sir.
I'm all over the place today, actually. I had all these lined up beforehand, but I just didn't know what I'd be talking about. I had to wait till about 1:30 in the morning last night.
Well, what are you talking about? In terms of these returns, what's jumping out at you?
Demographics. In 1992, the message from the Clinton campaign that became famous, of course, was, it's the economy, stupid. This election, I think, this 2008 and this election, the message is, it's the demographics, stupid. In 1988, the percent of the electorate, presidential electorate that was white, was 85%. Slowly that's declined. It's now down to 72% in the presidential campaign last night. 72% white, 28% non-white. That only matters if the percent of voting people, the voting preferences of whites and non-whites differs. And it does dramatically. Non-whites vote for the Democratic Party around 80%+. And that demographic shift in this country has been deeply facilitated by the policies of the different parties and by the people leading those parties.
What are whites voting at in percentage-wise?
Well, they voted
different parties.
Well, whites are voting about 65-35. Last night, Obama won 40% of whites in this country.
He had to, right, in order to
about 40%. The 80-40 line, according to Ron Brownstein, this well-known national columnist, Obama had to win 40% of whites, and then he had to win 80%+ of minorities, and that's about what he had both of those.
So, are we a racially divided nation? Does that demographics tell you that, or are we just a nation that has one political party who is not talking to minorities?
It's definitely the latter. We're a racially divided political party system. And you don't have to take my word for it. Look at the leader. Look at the people that are right now, today already, stepping up on the Republican side to say we need to reach out to minorities. How can we expect to win any national election when we're getting 5% of African Americans and we're getting far less than we used to among Latinos, just as a stat to take to kind of chew on. In 2004, George W. Bush won re-election with 40% of the Latino vote in this country. In 2008, John McCain lost and he won 31% of the Latino vote. Last night, Mitt Romney lost and he won 21% of the Latino vote. You can't win on the national level with that. And so Marco Rubio already coming out today and saying two things. One, we need to be more inclusive. And two, I'm not running the National Republican Senate Committee for the next 2 years because I want to change this party in different ways.
But the Republicans did make efforts to reach out to Latinos. And yet in the south of Florida, where you thought maybe they'd run stronger because there's a stronger Cuban mm-hmm. population, they seem to have some trouble.
There were certain members of the party that have reached out to Latinos. Rubio is one of them. Lindsey Graham in South Carolina. Jeb Bush, the former governor of Florida. But your presidential standard bearer for the Republican Party this year said in the primaries that undocumented immigrants should self-deport. That's when he lost this election. When he decided he needed to run to the right of Rick Perry on immigration, Perry looks positively moderate compared to Mitt Romney on immigration. And I think that the Republican Party has a significant demographic issue, both in terms of Latinos. But let me add two other pieces. In 1980, Ronald Reagan won 14% of African Americans in this country. George W. Bush won 11% of African Americans in 2004. They've won 4% of African Americans in the last two elections. So will those voters come back after Barack Obama's not on the ticket or not? They have to solve that issue too, the Republican Party. And then when you look at youth, in 2008, 18% of the electorate was under 30. And the conservatives were just certain that would not be replicated this election. They're right. It was 19% of the electorate yesterday. And those voters voted 60% for Obama yesterday, 66% for Obama in 2008. So young voters, the growing racial composition in this country that's diverse, forces one of these political parties to significantly change. And they will if they want to be a major party.
David Domke's with us. We'll take a break. We'll come back, talk more about some polling and some of the other issues that have been arising in the outcome of this campaign and this election. This is Week 10.
Good morning, it's 9:23. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle, news and information.
Support for KUOW comes from the UW World Series, presenting Cedar Lake Contemporary Ballet, performing a program of Seattle premieres by Canadian Crystal Pite and other international choreographers. November 15th through the 17th at Meany Hall. Tickets at uwworldseries.org.
We have cloudy skies and 51 degrees in Seattle. We're expecting a high today right around 51. Forecast says partly sunny a little bit later, still though a chance of showers. Tonight, partly cloudy, chance of showers, the low in the upper 30s. We're expecting partly sunny skies tomorrow, but fairly cool. Tomorrow's high in the upper 40s.
We are looking at what happened in this election. David Domke is professor and chair in Department of Communication at the University of Washington. He's in our studios. He's also author of The God Strategy, How Religion Became a Political Weapon in America, which I want to get to in a moment. And getting there by way of bringing in Todd Donovan, professor of political science at Western Washington University, published several books on elections and the voting process. His latest, Reforming the Republic, Democratic Institutions for the New America, and Electoral Reform and Minority Representation, Local Experiments with Alternative Elections. Todd Donovan, thank you for joining us.
Good morning.
What'd you see in the polls that also showed itself in the outcome of this race that sort of dovetails with what David Domke was saying about a shifting demographic?
Oh, I think demographics are everything. But one of the more striking things about this election, the presidential election, maybe in some of the stuff here in Washington State, is it was really predictable. I mean, we spent, whatever, $6 billion and all the attention about the debates and people speculating about the effect of the hurricane or the superstorm. And at the end of the day, the results really kind of look like what a lot of people would have expected maybe even a year ago. And I think that is really driven by the economy. So, I mean, demographics are everything, but we have to think, you know, why are Latino voters drawn to the Democratic Party? Why are African-American voters? And a lot of that has to do with the economic policies of those parties, of the parties, but also, you know, just voters are looking at the economy in 2012, and the exit polls show, you know, there's much more optimism, and the incumbent is benefiting from that. About half of the people in the exit polls nationally are saying the country is on the right track, and that was just, you know, not, and very few people were saying that 4 years ago. So I don't think we should underestimate the importance of people just, you know, looking backwards, asking themselves, am I doing okay? Is the country doing okay? And on balance, I think that's really what drove an election, that drove the results that we're looking at.
You know, when you look at polling numbers, David Domke, even among those people polled saying wrong track or President Obama didn't do everything he said he was going to do, that doesn't necessarily translate into a vote against the president. That's what we've seen. People had longer memories than they were being given credit for. They looked at George Bush. They looked at what had happened. Overall, what's your sense of how the electorate at the presidential level, because I know it gets broken down individually, perceived this election? How did they flow with it over the course of these months?
The exit polls showed yesterday that about 55% of the public, people who are coming out of the exit polls, blame George Bush primarily for the economy. About 30% blamed Barack Obama. So, you know, the American public gets a bad rap on issues of politics. They don't supposedly pay enough attention. They're easily moved by shiny metal objects. But, you know, I consistently find they make pretty thoughtful decisions when they get to the voting, when they vote. And they're not always the decisions that that person A would like. But they have values that they're voting. And I think in this particular election, what you saw was that people said the economy is very important, and I think we're getting better. We're not there, but we're getting better. And Bill Clinton had a lot to do with that with his speech at the convention. I'd never probably seen anybody whose single speech, I think, had more impact on public sentiment on the economy than Clinton's, because the people that bounced after that in terms of hope about the economy were Democrats. Hmm. And I think that he really shifted that. But so there's enough increase in hope on the economy, plus I think the reality, the sense that Barack Obama's had 4 years, it's not enough time to turn around a terrible recession, and the Republicans bear some significant responsibility for that. If it hadn't been Bush that had left this way, then I think Obama would have lost, because he just would have had to run on solely on his record. But the reality is he walked into a disaster.
Let me look at Washington State for a bit in terms of that notion of who's voting and who came out. Kirby Wilbur, the Republican chair, said we're a libertarian state. That was one of his quotes. When you look, Todd Donovan, around the state at the different outcomes for the different initiatives, including the initiatives just the advisory votes on whether a tax should be kept or not kept, as well as the same-sex marriage, the two-thirds majority, and the marijuana. Are we a libertarian state?
Well, there's elements of libertarianism in our history and tradition. But no, I think if anything, you look at these results and it looks a Democratic state looking even more solidly Democratic. And the referendum 74 is actually, I think that's very sort of telling. You know, you've got 52% support for that, and we wouldn't have expected that a few years ago. But I don't think we can necessarily call that a libertarian message. But you've got the governor's race trending towards the Democrats, Obama running strong. There's some libertarianism to that. But I want to point out something about the referendum 74 thing, because I was, you know, we were expecting Washington to maybe be the first state to legalize same-sex marriage and the first state to legalize marijuana. We're actually seeing this in some other states, but the the trend on that attitudes about same-sex marriage from, if we just remember back to 4 years ago, not only in Washington but nationally, every poll and every referendum was maybe, you know, barely showing 40% support for the idea of same-sex marriage. And now, you know, the four votes that we saw across the country, all of them were coming in sympathetic to the idea of same-sex marriage. That's a really dramatic change in just a short period of time in terms of public opinion.
Well, let me, I'll tell you what, at this point, let me bring in Ann Levinson, who is the former deputy mayor, chief of staff for Seattle Mayor Norm Rice. She's also one of the leaders in the LGBT community and one of the people leading the discussion about Referendum 74. Hello, Ann.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So, Ann, first of all, we have votes yet to be counted around the state, and, of course, many of them in King County. What do you think, what do you see happening? What's the trend?
Well, it's looking very good. We have about 60% of the ballots counted at this point. We still have quite a few, as you mentioned, in King to be counted. But if the trends hold, we should have some good news in the next couple of days.
What happened? What happened with the electorate from your perspective around the state?
Well, around the state, we were consistent with what we saw nationally. I mean, it really was a tremendous shift. It was a landmark day at the ballot box for LGBT equality all across the country. In all four states where we had marriage equality on the ballot, the coalitions came together that included faith and business and just incredible support across all sorts of communities. There were independents, Republicans, as well as Democrats in all these states. And in Minnesota, in the middle of the country, right, in the heartland, Minnesota became the first state in the country to reject an attempt at amending the state constitution to write in discrimination against same-sex couples. And in Maine, they became the first state in the nation to vote for same-sex marriage, putting a measure on the ballot themselves. And then in Maryland, where folks had written them off, saying, you know, they have a large Catholic population, they have a significant African-American population, they won't support marriage equality. In fact, they did, also resoundingly. So I think what we saw here was reflective of what we're seeing across the country. And I should add to that, not only on marriage equality, but if you take a look at the congressional races, Tammy Baldwin became the first out lesbian to ever be elected to the U.S. Senate in Wisconsin, the home of Paul Ryan. And we won, I think, a half a dozen seats in Congress with openly gay folks running, which in our history is a very significant accomplishment. So I think you're seeing a landmark shift in public understanding and in us moving a step closer to equality.
Let me come back to that question of acceptance. Stay with us, Ann, but let me circle around and start with you, David Domke, since you've written about it. What role, in terms of 74, but you can go broader as well, what role did faith and the faith communities play in this shift at all? Can we tell?
Yeah, we can. For the first time since 1980, Democrats and progressives were on the offensive and not ducking and covering on social issues. All across the board, the progressive causes on GLBT, on women's rights, on immigrant rights, were the majority positions in this election. We had a president who said that he supported same-sex marriage, get reelected, and it worked to his advantage politically, not against him. You have to recognize that faith has been dominated in American politics by conservative faith since the rise of the religious right in the 1970s. I think that we're in the midst of a transition in which it's not going to swing to the left, but it's a more balanced conversation. I think Catholics are more mixed on matters. White evangelical turnout was much lower yesterday than it had been. So I think that we're in the midst of a transition. It's all about a changing demographic nation. And that's what has produced so much anxiety and also so much hope for many people.
Todd Donovan, follow up on that and a sense of how that plays out over the next few years in this state.
Yeah, well, I think if we think back to 2004, people looking at the exit polls and made this big deal about everybody. You know, the number one issue people mentioned was moral values, and that how that helped the Bush coalition. I think that was overstated then. So, you know, things have changed a lot in terms of the influence of social conservatives in the Republican Party. But I think we started from a perspective where we might have overestimated that in 2004. But, you know, there's been this amazing trend towards liberalization in attitudes about same-sex relations. And I, Obama was almost sort of behind the curve on that.
Mm-hmm.
How's that playing out here in Washington? If you look at some of the states where this is on the ballot, Maine and Minnesota and Washington, you know, we might be sort of at the higher end of liberal attitudes on these things. But I think when you have votes on this and even votes on stuff like marijuana here, states like Washington are going to be pushing the discussion more nationally now. You're telling legislators who maybe used to be afraid of these issues, the public's on your side, and you might see some action in other state legislatures. And it can even be signaling to the courts that, these are issues where majorities of the public in many states and even in national polls have come to a different position than I think a lot of people in office think. You know, the public is in a different place than where a lot of elected officials think it might be, and in terms of having more acceptance and more liberal attitudes.
And Ann Levinson, anything you want to add to that?
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. One of the biggest changes we've seen in the last few years, I don't know if you recall, but just a few years ago there was an attempt to unseat in Iowa the Supreme Court justices who had ruled in favor of marriage equality. And this year there was another attempt to do that, and that got pushed back, and that was in Iowa. So, again, another state in the heartland stood up very strongly for marriage equality. And I think the reason we're seeing that here and across the states is because we've changed the debate to have honest and authentic discussions. People are telling their stories about their families and why it matters to them and how this discrimination, this exclusion from the institution of marriage harms them. So it's no longer a theoretical debate the way it was in the days of Roe in politics when he played to our worst instincts. Instead, it's a discussion about our common humanity and about caring for each other. And we have a long history in this state of voters being very compassionate and thoughtful and standing up for their friends and neighbors. We've been attacked on many fronts over the years, and we have always come together as a state. And I think this is reflective of that ethic among us.
You wanted to say something?
Yeah, I always wanted to add, Steve, that these state outcomes really matter. For 32 elections in states in the last decade had gone against marriage equality advocates. Last night, all four went for marriage equality folks. That's a tremendous shift. But here's why it really matters. In 2003, when the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against anti-sodomy laws in Bowers v. Hardwick, they pointed to state laws and changing opinions in states as a reason for that. They're about to consider at the national level, the support for DOMA and for same-sex marriage. I think that this outcome, these four states, very different regions of the country, going like this is incredibly important. Had it been another four losses for folks that are supporting marriage equality, then the Supreme Court could say, look, 36 times it's been on the ballot and it's lost. We can't go against that, right? I think this really is a pivotal moment.
And last question for you. In the last couple of weeks of this campaign for Referendum 74, ads and articles and comments that were back to the old sort of arguments, equating what was going to happen in schools with criminality and pedophilia. Any evidence that affected voting around the state?
Yeah, those are the same arguments they've used ad nauseum, and they do play the fears of folks. If you don't have time, if you don't have an opportunity to have personal conversations with people and that's all they hear, that can be effective. So that ended up, if we end up in this range of 52%, that is pretty consistent with what our polling projected would happen if the other side aired those kind of arguments. But as you can see from the results in all four of those states, those arguments are wearing thin. People are becoming much more understanding. And the other side has not been able to come up with anything to change the debate. And so this will only, as we go further over the years, we will only see more and more states stand up and join in the opportunity of marriage equality. I would add to that, on the issue of the Supreme Court, not only is it four states, but it's different circuits across the country.
Hmm.
So that is also a very effective argument for us to move forward on those DOMA lawsuits.
All right, Ann. I appreciate you taking the time this morning.
You bet.
Ann Levinson is a former deputy mayor. She's a leader in the LGBT community and led a local ownership group to keep the Seattle Storm in town as well. I want to turn with Todd Diamond and David Domke. I want to turn to the question of money and all this. Justin Elliott is a reporter for ProPublica, focusing on the dark money and the effects of Citizens United. Justin, thanks for talking to us.
Good to be here.
So I know this is the first of many questions we're going to have about this, and I'm sure you'll be looking at it over the days ahead. What evidence was there that the billions that were spent impacted particular races or had the outcome that the people spending the money thought they would have on the presidential race?
Yeah, I think as a general matter, the sort of principle here is that money matters in politics, but it's not 100% determinative. You can't buy an election. I mean, we have plenty of examples this cycle. Linda McMahon, the Republican Senate candidate in Connecticut, ran twice for a Senate seat, spent literally $100 million of her own money, which she made running the WWF wrestling company, and lost both times. So, I mean, you can't buy a result, but money does matter in the election. I mean, look, if you look at the presidential level, President Obama raised about $1 billion for his campaign. So he was pretty even with the Republicans on that level, and he won. So, it's hard to say on the level of a particular race. It's hard to sort of to separate money from other variables. But I think as a general matter, you know, we know it matters.
Todd Donovan, you've been looking at money at all in these races?
Yeah, and I agree. I mean, we know it matters, but I think it's pretty striking how much money was spent in, like, the Ohio Senate race against Sherrod Brown and some of these others, where, you know, the outside money, the Karl Rove, the Crossroads GPS money, really just didn't look like it moved the needle. And, in this sort of post-Citizens United world, I think we were actually... A lot of us were anticipating that we'd see more effects of that kind of money. And it might be that there's a point of, you know, diminishing marginal returns. You can only spend so many tens of millions of dollars in a Senate race before it just doesn't have any effects. We know from research, you know, it gets people paying more attention to the campaigns. It gets them kind of more sour attitudes towards the candidates when they're getting saturated with all this. But you know, we're going to be spending a lot of time after this election trying to figure out why the money really didn't make as much of a difference as I think people were fearing when the dark money groups were getting set up.
Yeah, dark money is a good phrase for it. What do you think?
Well, I'll say this. There's almost this contradiction that occurs with the rise of more money in that it places greater emphasis on campaign first-person contact. What you have is with the rise of all this money, the way you are able to beat it, if you don't want to raise billions yourself, is you have to build this incredible on-the-ground, neighbor-to-neighbor operation. And that's what the Obama campaign put together in the swing states. He had raised plenty of money himself, but he didn't have near the outside support that Romney had. So I think that just like in our technological arena, the rise of mediated online technologies has prompted a greater value to person-to-person contact. I think the rise of all this money actually puts the onus back on retail politics. And that's an interesting outcome that you wouldn't have expected.
You know, Justin, I was curious. You guys have looked at different things. You looked at who the big donors were for these PACs. You look at how they're spending money. You asked the question of who's making money from all this campaign spending. I mean, the last few weeks, the Romney campaign and the dark money groups spent lots of money in Pennsylvania. They went to other places to contest what looked like might have already been uncontestable or not necessary to contest those states. Was it just to spend the money?
Sure. I mean, that theory is certainly out there. It's always sort of hard to tell for sure because, you know, the finances of these groups are generally private. But, I mean, look there have been reports of some people who run some of the better-funded outside groups, you know, buying second and third vacation homes. It's hard to link that directly to campaign spending. But yeah, I mean, you look at you mentioned some of the pro-Republican super PAC spending in favor of Romney in Pennsylvania late in the game. There was a theory out there that they just had this money to burn that had been given to them by, you know, these wealthy donors like the Sheldon Adelsons of the world, and they just wanted to get it out there so they could get their commissions before Election Day, and because after Election Day, there was really no justification for spending it. So, I mean, that's potentially a factor, I think.
All right. Do they have to, what happens to the money that didn't get spent, do you know, with some of those dark groups? Can they just hang on to it for 2 years?
Yeah, often actually you see they do just hang on to it. I mean, and that's the same is true with campaigns. Sometimes you see them giving it to charity. I was noticing looking through some of the federal election filings that, of all people, Rudy Giuliani's presidential campaign committee actually still has a bunch of money, and they've been, every couple months, they've been paying several thousand dollars to Rudy Giuliani's law firm for some sort of unspecified legal consulting. So, yeah, they're not under any obligation to spend the money at all.
Wow. All right. Justin Elliott works with ProPublica. We're going to look more into the money in the days ahead. David Domke, you want to say something about that money? Well,
I mean, we don't. This is just one election, so we don't want to extrapolate beyond that. But billions and billions were spent on this election by outside groups, most of that on the conservative side. And the reality is that not a single incumbent Democrat in the Senate lost, and the president, who Democrat incumbent won. So what they got for all that is they got a new Republican senator in Texas.
Well, they got a lot of governors, and we'll see what the House looks like. They preserved their House.
They preserved the majority.
Yeah. Todd Donovan, last word from you on what this money has meant and what we learned from it.
I guess it's sort of echoed what David said. It is, there's probably a lot of people out there scratching their heads, asking themselves, what'd they get for all the money they spent. You really start running out of places to spend it. There just aren't that many competitive states. There just aren't that many Senate seats that are going to be up. So, I mean, part of the reason why that money was going into Pennsylvania is that, everybody had already voted in Ohio enough that it wasn't worth spending any more money there in the last few days. So, it's going to be something we'll be trying to figure out. Where did it maybe make an effect? But at the end of the day, it might be how the money is spent, like on the ground game and those sorts of things, and that these crossroads type groups really are just going on television, and the local stations are making a lot of money. Cable broadcasters are making a lot of money, but I think there are diminishing returns on where you're going to get off that stuff.
Yeah. All right, Todd Donovan, I appreciate you taking the time this morning. Todd Donovan is a professor of political science at Western Washington University. Also, I talked to Justin Elliott, reporter for ProPublica. We're going to shift and talk about one more issue and get some last words from David Domke as well. This is Weekday on KUOW.
Every memory you think you have of the past?
The house you grew up in. Your first kiss.
It's not simply an idea. It's a physical trace left in your brain.
I own those memories. They define me.
But what happens when those memories are stolen from you?
In the blink of an eyelid.
Can you imagine what to have one night 20 years long? That's what it's been like. Just like death.
That's this week on Radiolab.
And the next Radiolab is Friday night at 7 o'clock. Good morning, it's 9:48. You're tuned to 94.9 KUOW Seattle. News and information.
Support for KUOW comes from Pacific Medical Centers, offering preventive care and workplace health risk assessments to support healthy lives. Same day, evening, Saturday, Sunday, and online doctor appointments available through MyChart at pacmed.org.
We have cloudy skies, 49 degrees in Seattle, working towards a high of 51 today. Forecast says partly sunny skies with a chance of showers. It's going to be partly cloudy tonight. Chance of showers, the low in the upper 30s.
Environmentalist Bill McKibben and 350.org kick off their Do the Math Climate Change Tour today. And he's looking at the math of climate change. Bill McKibben, I also am wondering if you're looking at the math of this election in terms of the lack of discussion about climate change, until I heard President Obama say something in his acceptance speech last night. Bill McKibben, thanks for talking to us.
Well, it's good to be with you. Yes, it was great to hear the president break his climate silence in his victory address, and then to hear the huge roar that went up the minute he mentioned it. We were watching closely the results last night, and because we're kicking off this huge tour the night after the election on purpose, I mean, no matter who won, we were going to do it. But now there's a real opening to get something done if we push, if we press, if we give our guys some political space to do what needs doing. The most significant, I think, piece of data, perhaps, from our least talked about, but most significant from the polling last night, was that about 19% of the voters were under the age of 30, even a higher percentage than in 2008. And for them, climate is always the number one or number two issue. And the president will find out what happens when he doesn't have an election hanging over him, when he doesn't have to worry so much about the immense power of the fossil fuel industry. We'll see in decisions about things like the Keystone Pipeline whether or not he's going to stand up.
Well, Bill McKibben, Keystone Pipeline, I will bet you that they're going to approve that. And there is this pressure as well to talk about clean coal as being something that is already happening. We just have to put more scrubbers on the coal plants that exist or the ones.
Pressure.
What's that?
Always pressure, and everybody was willing to bet, a year ago that they were going to build the Keystone Pipeline too. And so far, everybody lost. If we build movements, then we will have some success in this fight. And movement building is what we're about. That's what this tour is about. 21 cities in the next 21 nights, beginning in Seattle. And the whole point is to spark a movement that goes directly at the fossil fuel industry, goes directly at the people who poisoned our politics with all those endless ads and contributions, the people who have poisoned our atmosphere. This draws on an article I wrote this summer for Rolling Stone, which became one of the most shared articles in Rolling Stone's history. I mean, Justin Bieber was on the cover of the issue, but somehow my article on climate change got 10 times as many likes on Facebook. So we're going in a very big way with this. This show tonight in Seattle, I think, is sold out, though. I was just told there may be about 50 seats that came free for the walk-up window at Ben Arroyo Hall, but it's selling out everywhere because, because people understand what we're up against. Look at this past year. While the president's been delaying on Keystone, we've had the warmest year in American history. We've had an epic drought. The Arctic has melted. And, Sandy crashed into the Northeast. And that week, last week, that radical journal, Business Week, put on its cover in huge yellow letters, "It's global warming, stupid."
Now, I saw that. But here's my question. Here's my question for you, Bill. What do you say to the Republican House at this point? Do you have to bring them along? Is there something you can say to them?
Well, that's why the stuff that's most likely to happen first are the stuff that the White House can do itself, Keystone being a clear example. New regulations to the EPA on coal-fired power plants being another example. We're going to have to, one's going to hope that the Republicans in the House look around and see what the future looks like, that young voters are paying no attention to them, that people who, live in the path of these kind of storms and whatever are beginning to wake up to what's going on. I mean, look at Chris Christie's transformation over the last week. It's none of it easy. None of it easy because they're up against the richest industry in the history of the world. Exxon made more money last year than any company in the history of money. But if we build movements, then we have a chance. And that's, that's always how it works. When people went to school 25 years ago in this big divestment movement to try and bring down the apartheid government, the Republicans controlled Congress and Ronald Reagan was in the White House, and yet they convinced 200 colleges and universities to sell their stock in apartheid South Africa, and that was a big help in that fight. When Nelson Mandela came to the U.S., after he got out of prison, the first place he went was the University of California to say thanks to students for having spurred that movement. That's why we're trying to launch a similar thing on campuses around the country. We'll be doing civil disobedience at shareholder meetings as the year goes on. We need people to understand that at this desperate point in our history, the fossil fuel industry has become a kind of rogue industry, almost an outlaw industry, not against the laws of the state, which they too often get to write, but against the laws of physics. Say, look what happened in the Arctic this summer. We broke one of the biggest physical features on Earth. We cannot keep doing this.
All right, Bill. I appreciate it that you're talking to us. Bill McKibben is kicking off his Do the Math tour about climate change tonight at 7:30 at Benaroya Hall. We have links to math.350.org. You can see what they're doing in terms of doing the math. Brian Bucklew, our producer, said in a way climate change helped President Obama win because he had to walk with Chris Christie. And I think a lot of people, just as Bill McKibben was saying, say, oh, yeah, climate change. That's something to think about. What other meanings are you getting, David Domke, from 2008 and 2012?
You know, I think that these are one way to look at these elections is that they're pretty much the same outcome. That in 2008, Democrats took a large majority in the Senate. President Obama was elected, and they had the House at that time. In 2012, Obama wins a re-election. The Democrats gain a few seats in the Senate. They don't have the House, but it's not a big change in the House election. So it's kind of it's almost one way to think about it is the status quo was held in 2012. I think that's completely the wrong way to look at this. Here's how I would think about this. And I'm still, this is in motion on me. I'm still thinking about this, but this is kind of my takeaway right now. In 2008, the American electorate that voted for Barack Obama scored a decisive accomplishment for the United States, first African-American president. What was a defining element of that election was the accomplishment of electing Barack Obama. What we have in 2012 is a decisive decision by the American public of who this country is going to be. In 2008, it was about electing the person, Obama. In 2012, it's about the country we're going to be. I think this was a choice election. Obama won a choice election. It wasn't an election about one person, one man versus another man. It was a decision about who are we as a nation of immigrants? Who are we as a nation of women and men, gay and straight? Last night in his election speech, Obama said, able-bodied and disabled. No one's ever said that as president. So the reality is that what we got with president in 2004, in a way, was the audacity of hope. I think that what we've got now is the audacity of inclusion. A brand new electorate, an American public, it's divided, but a choice has been made. And the Republican Party now faces a decision about whether they want to join with that future. And I think their answer is going to be a resounding yes.
Does what Bill McKibben was talking about in terms of young people building a movement and focusing on science rather than gut feelings, does that play into that?
Absolutely. What we saw in sports in the early 1990s was the rise of the money ball culture, using data and science to figure out small trends that make a big difference and allowed these small market teams to compete against the New York Yankees. What we have now in politics is the rise of moneyball politics, targeting of the electorate. Nate Silver at 538.com, 50 out of 50 in his state predictions. Against all of these pundit feelings, like I feel this, I feel that. I don't care about your feelings. This is what the science says, all right? And that's what we saw with this election, and I think that's what we're seeing with the rise of a new body of people, new generation that says we're multicultural, we're diverse, and we're grounded in knowledge and thinking as opposed to this kind of divided racially, gender, ethnically, sexually electorate. I am far more hopeful the day after the election today than I was in 2008 for America.
Hmm.
Absolutely.
The fact-based community won, huh?
You know, it's ironic, but the reality usually gets here. But people have to make choices. And I'm, as a teacher and as a parent, always want people to make choices because then they buy in. We made a choice, and this election will take us forward.
David Domke is a professor and chair, Department of Communication at the University of Washington. Thank you for spending the hour with us.
Yeah, thank you, Steve.
More to come. This is Weekday.
And now, the sound of the day.
So our sound today comes from Willie Weir, weekday's bicycle correspondent. He's traveling in Bangkok. That's the sound of the Chao Phraya Express boat. The pilot of the boat drives up in front. Passengers embark and disembark from the rear of the boat. And there's a man in the back of the boat. He whistles commands to the pilot, and each whistle has a different meaning. Sort of hear it there in the background. More stories from Willie and more sounds from you, I hope. Send them to us weekday at kuow.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.